you know, their families would be informed if something would happen to them. Their government would do everything to get them back if they became prisoners. And they believed that. And none of those things were kept by, those promises were kept by the government. And those families have been fighting ever since to try to get their men back. Because the policy was, you just, if you lose the men in that kind of situation, and the government might be embarrassed by what is going on, and later on the group of people might be embarrassed when the government wasn't involved anymore at all, you just write them off. And, you know, that is really the whole basis of our story, that somehow this group of people controlling this issue felt that they had to the right to make that decision for American servicemen. And that goes against everything that the United States stands for. I mean, it is unconstitutional. It is illegal. And yet somehow they have seized that power to do it. And that's why this issue is so important. But they've been very clever in discrediting it as, you know, an issue that's only of concern to Rambos and people who are crazy or whatever. You know, because a lot of people don't take it seriously. They believe the movies and they like it, but it's just an adventure yarn to them. And they don't realize what rights are at issue here.
Site 85, it should be explained, was a secret site in Laos, which technically was neutral. The justification for it was that the communist Vietnamese were abusing neutrality by making the Ho Chi Minh Trail swing round through through Laos. The Site 85 personnel were highly trained technicians working very sophisticated equipment, which had been placed on top of a mountain, and that equipment was directing the very high-level bombers against North Vietnamese targets. Now, the armed forces personnel who were sent to Site 85 and rotated through were based in Thailand, and as far as anybody publicly knew, that's where they were living and working. But they were sanitized, that is, they were put into anonymous clothing, flown out by helicopter to Site 85 for periods of time, and then rotated back to Thailand for rest and recreation. They had been sworn to secrecy, and they were supposedly under no illusion about the fact that they were involved in a covert war. But they did get assurances that they were still being treated as armed forces personnel. And this is where we're getting into a very shady area. Armed forces personnel have a right to know when they are getting involved in illegal forms of warfare that might expose them to the accusation that they're war criminals, or deprive them of any rights, for that matter, under international law. And we found case after case coming up of men who were continuing to be sent into covert warfare situations as armed forces personnel based in Thailand after the war in Vietnam officially had come to an end. And in one or two cases, we have the notes and letters that they were in the process of writing home or to their to people in Washington, asking just exactly what their position was. These were men who were not legal experts. Their consciences simply told them that there was something wrong about this. They were being sent into operations after the war had officially ended, and they were very worried about their position. When they went to their own commanding officers, they were told, you must obey orders. And the natural instinct of any good man in the armed forces is to carry out orders. But we're into this gray area now where covert warfare is formalized as the third option. It has gained a certain amount of credibility. It was formulated, and a book was published on the subject by Theodore Shackley, the CIA station chief in Laos, who later became one of the deputy directors of operations under George Bush when he was director of the CIA. And this third option theory appeals to a certain kind of intellectual who does not get himself involved in the actual fighting, but controls the controlled assets, which in some cases may be American Armed Forces men. And I think what offends the hell out of a lot of Special Forces people is that this is done at a distance. And the people who are the aficionados of third option warfare don't themselves expose themselves to any kind of danger at all.
I'm sure the audience would, so those who have not read the book, which is most of them, no doubt, would be interested in hearing about what you learned about the use of POW missions as fronts for clandestine warfare.
Well, there are a lot of examples that we document in the book, and one, or several actually, are instances where money was actually collected by POW groups. And then their name was used. That money was sent to another country, like Thailand, for example, to be laundered. And it was then used for intelligence operations that had nothing to do with POWs. So that, you know, the issue was simply used. In one instance, the funding went to Afghanistan. In another instance, it was for a different kind of resistance group in Vietnam that had nothing to do with POWs. But, you know, that kind of thing has gone on, and I think is still going on all the time.
You're getting into an area of exploiting people who can't defend themselves, because POWs were an ideal way of pretending to do something on behalf of the missing men while doing something quite different. The Joint Casualty Research Center in Bangkok, JCRC, has really nothing to show for all its years of existence, set up at the end of the Vietnam War to try and resolve casualty problems. The official title is Joint Casualty Resolution Center. It is up to this minute unable to give any full account of what it has been doing, but it always protects itself by saying, well, this is a national security issue. It's not a national security issue if no accounting is being given to the families and colleagues and relatives and so on of the men who are missing. All these years that it has existed, there has been no evidence that the public is aware of that it has done anything except try to discredit eyewitness reports. Now, to go one step further from there, POWs are a very useful cover for doing other things. So are refugees. And the refugees from the Cambodian War, located in camps all along the Cambodian border, have become a most extraordinarily useful means of training the Khmer Rouge, the favored people, the favored controlled assets, who under Pol Pot practically destroyed the educated strata of society in Cambodia, to carry on the war against the Communist Vietnamese. When the Communist Vietnamese said, all right, we're going to withdraw from Cambodia in order to get better deals with the Americans and try and get out of the mess we're in, and that was only a year ago, every effort was made to persuade the rest of the world that the Vietnamese were still, in fact, inside Cambodia, in order that the aid that was being given to the Khmer Rouge from America, disguised as non-lethal aid for refugees, and from China more openly as armed supplies to the Khmer Rouge, all of this was suddenly put into some jeopardy. A Cambodian working group consisting of U.S. covert warfare specialists was formed, and they were very successful for some months in continuing to give aid to the Khmer Rouge under Pol Pot, and their political arm has been successful until recently in defending the position that they alone, the Khmer Rouge, should be represented at the United Nations. But all this is beginning to fall apart. You cannot go on using refugees to conceal this kind of building up of a covert guerrilla army fighting communism on behalf of democracy. The whole thing is a nonsense, but it makes a lot of intellectual sense if you want to sit fiddling around writing textbooks in Washington about the third option. The POWSU has been, all through these years, described as manipulable. In fact, there was a report in today's New York Times from their Southeast Asian correspondent saying yet again, MIAs are a manipulable issue. And this is the standard phrase used by those people who do not want the American public to look more deeply into the whole story of what happened to these missing men and why it was permitted all these years to let a group controlling the issue to stop the facts, the defense intelligence reports, from reaching the American public.
One of the things that's impressive as a reader goes through Kiss the Boys Goodbye is the relative power and influence of the individuals and institutions that have been frustrated in their attempts to bring the POW/MIA issue to light. Obviously, the documentary that Monica was working on for 60 Minutes had the backing of CBS News. H. Ross Perot has a great deal of influence. People with very strong military and intelligence connections like Bo Greitz were frustrated as well, and obviously some people, such as Scott Barnes, were subjected to outright physical intimidation and attacks as well. One of the things that's interesting about the book to me is, again, the convergence of information and convergence of viewpoints of people like Danny Sheehan and H. Ross Perot. The Christic Institute has taken a lot of heat for their investigation, their lawsuit against many of the key principal figures in the Iran-Contra scandal, and they've been pretty thoroughly savaged in a lot of media circles, and yet, in spite of the fact that there are very obvious factual errors in the original Sheehan affidavit of the Christic Institute, various investigative bodies ranging from the Kerry Subcommittee on Narcotics and Terrorism to the Costa Rican judicial investigation, the Costa Rican investigation of many of the activities down there, and now, at least to a certain extent, some of the information from your book tends to corroborate elements, and again, I stress the use of the term elements, of the Christic Institute's allegations. One of the things that they have maintained, and one of the things that they have been attacked for as conspiracy theorists or paranoids or what have you, is that they have maintained, and I think anyone with any common sense that studies the intelligence services and national security establishment of this country will realize that that assertion is correct. There is, in effect, a government within a government. The United States now has a secret government, again, a government within a government that makes decisions not only against the will of the people, but against their well-being as well. In this case, obviously, the POWs and MIAs and their families, as well as anybody that attempts to go to bat for them. But to what extent do you feel that there is literally a government within a government, or to what extent do you feel that that is perhaps a rhetorical flourish, a verbal or rhetorical consideration?
Well, it depends on how you define that phrase, but when the Iran-Contra scandal broke, one of the top intelligence officers, whose name we have given to investigators, was meeting with us. He'd had 40 years of service in the armed forces. His loyalties were beyond question. His reputation was international. And he sat down and said that for the very first time in his whole life, his whole professional life, he questioned what government he had been reporting to. And what he meant by that was this, that the Defense Intelligence Agency is responsible for collecting intelligence on prisoners and responsible for collecting intelligence in a whole host of other areas, going all the way to the very top of the most sophisticated of communist weaponry. Its mandate is and was to pass on all that information. It was a collecting agency. It did not have the right to initiate any further action. And he had always assumed that the information that he was passing on was being acted upon. And in certain areas it was, in terms of meeting the Soviet threat and so on. But in the area of the very excellent intelligence that had been gathered and was continuing to be gathered on American prisoners, nothing was being done. And he had always assumed something was. The Iran-Contra scandal suddenly opened his eyes to this whole potential for the abuse of secrecy. Now, when the Christic Institute is accused of having got its facts here and there wrong, I think you have to recognize that when secrecy is applied in this totally immoral fashion for specific purposes, the facts become exceedingly hard to discover. And when the head of a defense intelligence agency says to you, for the first time I begin to wonder who I was reporting to, he is admitting, he wasn't trying to hide it, that on this one particular fact, which seemed to me to be one of the most important things of all, he did not know the facts either. We're open to criticism for the same reason, that when you're trying to put together a book of this kind, you have a very hard time documenting everything that you're writing. We did in the end, because of the pressure put upon the second set of publishers in New York, and the legal demand for documentation, produce evidence to support everything in the book. But some of that we still kept out of the book itself in terms of identifying people for their own safety, but they are identified to investigators. But what I would like to emphasize is that when secrecy is used by a government in this consistent way with one particular aim in mind, it is exceedingly difficult to get at the facts. We know this already from what is coming out as a result of perestroika from the Soviet Union, the Katyn Forest massacre, for example. Years and years, historians have argued about it. Now, at long last, we learn that it did indeed take place.
Well, it's the biggest weapon that has been used against the families and the veterans on this issue, because all of the material on prisoners has remained classified. It has remained secret from everyone, including those who constitutionally have a right to know what happened to the men who were lost, their families. And, you know, the reason for this has all along been, if we let you know this, then we will reveal to the enemy what our methods are for collecting that intelligence. Well, that's a ridiculous argument, because the enemy has that information. They know which prisoners they have, where they are, etc. And I'm sure in most instances they also know how that information was collected. I mean, after all these years. But it's sort of the perfect thing. We have the information and we're telling you that no men are alive and that no men were abandoned. But you can't check it out yourself. And this is why this committee report that came out is so important, because it is the first time that Congress has had a chance to look at some of this material. But I'll tell you how worried they were about senators and their investigators looking at this. Now, this investigation has been going on for a full year. And the chief investigator is a man who actually investigated a man who was terribly smeared and harmed, who was on a brilliant career track, a real hero in, you know, in the best sense, Major Mark Smith, who was head of Special Forces for Southeast Asia in the early 80s. And that included intelligence collecting activities. And he came across some of this incredible intelligence on prisoners and decided that he had to do something about it. Well, the moment he got involved with this, he was a ruined man, and everything happened to him, including criminal charges that were brought against him. Well, he was cleared of those criminal charges, and all the papers clearing him, that entire investigation was classified so that he could never publicly clear himself. But the investigator, the Criminal Investigative Division investigator, Tracy Usry, who did that investigation, never kind of forgot what happened. I mean, he was always intrigued by this. And the entire matter came to the attention of Senator Grassley from Iowa a little over a year ago. And he determined that he would get to the bottom of it. And he had difficulties from the very beginning because no one wanted him to see that report. He finally had to walk into the CID offices and walk out with the report himself, and also was able to get Tracy Ussery, the original investigator, assigned to this Senate Foreign Relations Committee investigation. And for a full year, those investigators and Grassley tried to get to look at the classified material, the live sighting reports on prisoners, and were not able to. And 2 months ago, Grassley went public and said to the Pentagon, why can't we see this stuff? The enemy knows what we're talking about. Why can't senators and their investigators look at this? Well, it took another 2 months until they were finally able to look at it. 3 weeks ago, they finally had a chance, and then it was with the proviso that Senator Grassley, and senators are busy people, had to be physically present every time the investigators looked at this. And to Grassley's credit, of course, he spent hundreds of hours going through the material with the investigators, and that is what is responsible for, finally, this interim report. But you have to wonder why they are so adamant about keeping this material from any objective reporter. And the reason is that it is just the biggest scandal that military men were actually abandoned and written off in the way they would be in any dictatorship, in any tyranny, written off in the same way, and then that is covered up, and the families who know better have had to fight harassment.
One of the things that I use for very frequently on my show here is the old cliche, the old street cliche, that what goes around comes around. As hackneyed as it might seem, just about everything I've learned in some 20-odd years of political research could be reduced to that formula in the end. What goes around comes around. This country has for many years been involved in covert operations abroad, frequently overthrowing democratically elected governments. In the third world, primarily Latin America, places like Iran and so forth. This is a matter of public record, and I think most people, certainly most liberals, are aware of this, and a lot of Americans certainly are aware of this. Yet it doesn't occur to people that, it doesn't occur to a lot of Americans, I guess I should say, that ultimately covert operations and anti-democratic action comes home to roost, that when you engage in these types of activities and you wield that sword against other people, sooner or later, that sword is going to be wielded against the American people as well. And in this particular instance, not only the prisoners themselves, but their families, as well as those of you who have undertaken a legitimate or an honest search for hard information about the prisoners, actually looking for the prisoners as opposed to using a search for the prisoners for a cover for other activities. Basically, you have been coming up against pressure, which at least some of which I think could be accurately termed covert action. The kinds of things that were done to Scott Barnes, for example, if indeed we can believe what he says, would certainly, to my mind anyway, fall into the category of covert operations, or at least military pressure, physical pressure, as opposed to simply blocking publication of a book or putting pressure for canceling a program. But in the end, the undemocratic means that we have used, the United States has used in certain parts of the world, is coming home to roost. And I was very impressed with the book itself, and yet at the same time I found it kind of depressing. I hope that this interim report, which now, as I understand you, Monica, that is covered in today's Washington Post, today being October 28th, 1990, for people who eventually hear this on tape.
That's right. And in addition to that, of course, there's also a truth bill before Congress, and we've been encouraging everybody to call up their own congressmen and senators and ask that this be passed, because that would mean the declassification of all of this material on prisoners. And once that is in the open, then the American people have a vehicle for pressuring the government to do something about getting, the men who are still there back. Because there are still men there, and although it would be a Pyrrhic victory because so many have died, it's something that's absolutely necessary, and only public opinion can do it, and only a branch of the government that is strong enough. Because even in the meeting with Thatch, who was just here last week, and he was allowed one day in Washington, that's the foreign minister of Vietnam, the question of prisoners never came up. The question of remains, bones, came up. but not prisoners. And that is exactly how we have always dealt on this issue. We have never, the U.S. government has never officially and publicly asked for the return of prisoners.
Maybe this is an impossible question to answer, but having looked into the situation, having experienced the pressure that you have experienced, and given the revelations that some of these prisoners might have to reveal, they might the things they might have to say if they got back, things talking about U.S. complicity in the drug traffic in Southeast Asia, for example, clandestine warfare going on in recent years against the Vietnamese, any of the kinds of activities that our government or the elements there of our government that don't want the story to come out, do you think that... given the revelations that could come from some of these POWs, do you think there's any chance that they would be allowed a safe return, or that the story will ever really get the play that it deserves?
I think it must ultimately come out. Your reference to these secret activities being a two-edged sword is absolutely right. We have, in the last few weeks, come up against extraordinary measures taken. For example, we flew into Chicago to do a radio talk show a few weeks back, and we were met at the airport by somebody who said, unfortunately, there had been a screw-up in the scheduling, and we were not on the show that night. So we weren't sorry. We went off to bed in our hotel, but I just happened to tune into that station anyway. And the host of the show had given the entire three-hour period to a spokesperson for the League of Families. Now, the League of Families ostensibly represents the families of the missing. In fact, it is an agency of the U.S. government. And somebody had anticipated our arrival and had got to the host of that particular show, who had been a public information officer, as he confessed on the air. And that person proceeded to kiss the boys goodbye, and damned us for having, and this is standard phraseology, exploited the misery and unhappiness of the poor people who have been left behind by the dead and missing.
An extremely ironic statement under the circumstances. Go ahead.
A pretty cynical comment, and
really
accused us of making money out of other people's misery when, in fact, we have given up 4 years of our own careers to pursue this. We didn't intend to when we started out. But the whole thing was quite shocking because it's not the kind of thing you expect to have happen in a democracy. It can happen in a totalitarian state, and even then, the public generally protests. Protests were, in fact, made in this case, but it was an attempt to sabotage our perfectly legitimate right to talk about something that we feel is of grave concern. If national security is threatened, it is threatened by these people who are trying to conceal rather than allow public debate. To this very day, we're not the slightest bit worried about confronting people who want to speak for the government. But nobody is willing to actually come on the air or in the television studio or before a public meeting and discuss openly with us this whole issue. We have been the subject of anonymous U.S. government attacks. We were on a recent television network talk show, and the host had been trying to find somebody to oppose us and finally came up with a U.S. government statement that dismissed us again as people exploiting the misery of the families left behind and so on, and the whole book was merely a fiction. I said, well, who in the U.S. government made this statement? Well, said the host, I can't tell you that. It turned out the statement had been issued by the Defense Intelligence Agency by way of the director of the League of Families, which, as I said earlier, is in fact an agency of the government, but professes to represent the families. To me, that is pure totalitarian tactics. It's the kind of thing that we have been accusing the KGB and the Soviet Union of doing for years and years and years.
And it really does become sinister, and it does very much affect everybody's rights, because There is one character in our book who we disguise. Again, he's been identified to investigators with his permission. But he is a former, very high-ranking intelligence man. And he actually was able to track down a unit, a government unit, that was set out to wreak havoc on this whole issue. In other words, give false information to families, pretend to ask for a lot of money to bring their loved ones back, and worse. I mean, there was an instance where a young woman was beaten up. The man himself had his office ransacked several times. I mean, really terrible things. Now, he had the courage to bring an official complaint about this, and he listed the names of the people who were involved. They were covert operations people. He brought those names to the Justice Department. He filed an official complaint and then waited and waited and waited. Now, this has been several years, and he could never figure out what exactly happened to that complaint. He just couldn't get any answer about it. And it was one of the things that was turned over to this investigative committee. And what they discovered was that, and I wouldn't have even been able to conceive of this before I learned how this is done. They went to the people against whom the charges had been brought, who said that it had to be submitted to a third government agency, and there is some kind of a ruling that a third agency has the right to stop an investigation of this kind. That third agency ruled that this investigation could go no further for reasons of national security, and the matter was dropped. And this is our highest recourse, isn't it? To be able to go to the Justice Department, because that's its name, justice. This is where you get justice. And this is the kind of thing that happens all the time. And of course, this is very serious for any ordinary American. Because if you lose those rights and freedoms, then you have very few left. Then you, you're basically living in a system where those rights don't exist.
When I first got involved in this thing, I thought that a number of the people that Monica had been talking to were verging on being paranoid. By now, when I recount these kinds of things, I find myself being very careful because I could sound paranoid to anybody not familiar with the situation. But let me give you an example. Monica's talking about interference inside the Justice Department. We were asked, because of this investigation on which an interim report has just been issued, to cooperate with the FBI. And we were willing to do this because we had reached the stage where the book was no longer just a book. We'd become involved in something that raised a lot of very basic questions about democratic rights. So we said, yes, to a certain degree we will. But the investigation committee out of the Senate, these are our lawmakers, said, would you please be sure to tell us what you tell the FBI, because in the past, reports of this kind have been stopped at some other level within the Justice Department, and we don't get to see them, although we know they've been made. So our recourse was to ask the sister agency in Canada, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who are tops in security matters, to provide us with a conference room at their headquarters and to be present when we talked to the FBI. And the FBI team, to their credit, agreed to this. They were working with complete integrity. And so we were able to talk to them and in this way assure the Senate investigators that they would be getting a report, because nobody was going to interfere in and make an attempt to stop that report going forward, knowing that there was a foreign security agency fully aware of exactly what we had said. Now, if I had heard myself saying this two or three years ago, I would have said, Stevenson, you've been reading too many spy thrillers. But in fact, that was the practical steps that we had to take to make absolutely certain that anything we had to say would get to the right people.
And Ed, it really isn't just us, because the sources that we had in the Pentagon, who are very, very high in covert operations themselves, and who spoke to us, yes, because they cared about the prisoners, but they cared even more about another issue, and that was the primary reason they spoke to us. And that is that they were concerned about the string of failures in every covert operation, in every intelligence activity. That, and I'm talking about legitimate activities. I'm talking about Chile Loro and the bombing of the Marines in Lebanon, and having left, having done nothing about the prisoners who were left behind. And as far as they were concerned, and I am not exaggerating this one bit, there has not been one success. And they saw no reason for that string of failures. I mean, they thought that, you know, what happened with the Iran rescue effort was absolutely ridiculous, where in every instance, the intelligence existed that these things, these terrorist activities would occur, that basically the people were prepared, that they were well trained, that they had good equipment, and they were willing. And then something went wrong, and they could not understand why something went wrong in every instance. And they wanted this brought into the open. They wanted various government committees to become aware of this and look into it, and that's why they talked to us.
Interestingly enough, both Richard Secord and Oliver North figured in the... You're talking about the April 1980 rescue attempt of the U.S. hostages in Tehran? Is that...
Yes, yes.
They were both involved with that raid, which raises the question, at least in that instance, of whether there may have been people who were involved with the raid who did not want it to succeed and who, in fact, wanted to see Jimmy Carter
embarrassed. You're right. This is the question that came up all the time. It was... What I was being told was that victory was not wanted, that somehow, even though, you know, there were good men involved in these activities, perfectly capable, who expected victory, something always went wrong. And they themselves couldn't figure it out. As a matter of fact, I had one conversation where I was absolutely flabbergasted that I was having a conversation like this, and I said, well, why? I mean, this was a new dimension to me. Why? And he formed one word with a question mark, and it was conspiracy. And, I mean, this was a man sitting right... We were sitting in the Pentagon having this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, the an awful lot of what has been dismissed in the past, or is still dismissed by certain people as conspiracy theory, is being borne out by what to some would appear to be relatively unlikely sources. Again, in your book, you talk about the convergence of information, but developed by sources as ideologically divergent, as H. Ross Perot and Bo Greitz on the one hand, and Daniel Sheehan of the Christic Institute on the other. One thing, although I was very impressed with the book, although I found it quite depressing in terms of the image presented. The thing that really depressed me most about the book was the extent to which key people within the Pentagon and the intelligence community were successfully frustrated in their efforts to bring out information concerning the POWs. I know, as a political researcher, I have seen private citizens and people with relatively little influence being frustrated in various attempts to bring out the truth about the national security establishment of this country. But I found it depressing that a lot of the people in your book who apparently experienced just as much frustration were quite well connected and would be able to, at least to my way of thinking, wield a lot more power than a private citizen would, and yet they also were frustrated. But one thing I did find very encouraging about the book was the extent to which, again, people like Dan Sheehan on the one hand and H. Ross Perot on the other hand were able to find common ground and perhaps a basis for common action on this or other issues in the future.
That's the way it ought to be, isn't it, really? What is distressing is that there should be these factions all fighting one another when surely we all have the same basic objectives, which is to protect our democratic rights and to protect American democracy and make sure that nothing damages it. And suddenly a kind of cancer has been seen to be growing in which the security agencies supposedly protecting our rights are being used against us. The reason that a lot of these highly respectable people talked to Monica and then to me was in part because she has a good reputation as an objective TV news producer and writer and reporter. And I had done a number of books on intelligence in the past, like A Man Called Intrepid, which were used really as a kind of Bible by a lot of intelligence people. The present head of the CIA, Judge Webster, quoted from my book before the confirmation hearings, when he came up for confirmation hearings, and the point he was making was that intelligence is a super weapon, a secret weapon, perhaps one of the most important weapons in the defense of democracy. And because it is secret, it also requires men of the highest integrity to take charge. What I find depressing, having gone through these past 5 years of looking into this whole thing, is that secret power, absolute secret power, corrupts so absolutely that there isn't any human being who can really resist the temptation, either for political reasons or for bureaucratic reasons or for reasons of profit, to at some point or another take advantage of that secrecy. And it leads me to the conclusion that we really have to rethink this whole situation very, very carefully. I don't know that we can any longer really sustain these huge intelligence bureaucracies. And this is where we're going to have a very big battle, because when you're spending $39 billion a year on intelligence, and when you have such huge bureaucracies dependent on this cult of intelligence, as it has been called, you're going to get an enormous number of people who do not want to see any kind of an independent inquiry into just exactly what is being done to defend American rights. And what is being done in the guise of national security for quite partisan reasons.
That, again, is something that the Christic Institute has been saying, that in essence the time has come, and they're certainly not alone in this regard. There is an organization whose name escapes me at the moment, but it's a group of retired national security and intelligence and alumni, and they who are critical of the CIA and its policies, and they have called basically for an end to covert operations. Again, talking about what I alluded to earlier, is that sooner or later, if you engage in covert operations and anti-democratic action abroad, it's going to come home, if only, as in this instance, to cover up from the American people the anti-democratic and illegal actions that their own government has been engaged in. Again, you made the point that the Vietnamese know about it. The only people that are being kept in the dark, so to speak, are the American people.
And the only people at the moment who are being kept in the dark about it, or maybe they have some sense of it, are the young men who are in the Middle East right now, because they have no more protection than the men had during the Vietnam War. I mean, they are just as likely to be sent into covert actions of some kind or other. I bet it's been reported that some of them are already engaged in those activities. And if tomorrow or next week it becomes embarrassing to the United States to admit that they were involved in those activities, and if they should be taken prisoner, they will be written off. There is nothing to prevent it. They have no more safeguards. Nothing has changed.